There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
What's good, internet? It is November 28th, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio. I am your host, Austin Walker. Joining me, as always, Patrick Klepek.
Is this one live?
This one is not live. This one is to tape.
Gotcha. Okay,
we could live be to doing
tape.
It live.
Live to tape.
We're at home right now, so it'd be easy to do it from live.
Yeah.
We're still working out our live solution in the studio, or in the office in Brooklyn. I think we're getting close. I think we have a solution today, but I had to stay home to play Final Fantasy this morning. Also joining me, Danielle Riendo. How are you doing, Danielle?
I'm doing great. I'm here from home. I have my kitten and my puppy.
Nice.
They're working with me. They're helping me edit. They point out typos a lot. They're always like, meow, that was a typo.
That's a good use to have. That's, most cats catch mice. Yours catch typos.
That's right.
That's
good. Very, very helpful.
You've been doing a lot of like kitten and dog streams lately. Lots of pet streams.
Yeah, it's been really, really fun. I played like 8 hours of Dishonored with my puppy on my lap the other day.
Nice.
And it was the most glorious way to play Dishonored and also to hang out with my dog.
How many levels of Dishonored did you get through in that 8 hours?
Like two.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I'm playing this game. I'm loving it, by the way. And, you know, I had only sort of dipped my toe in last we talked. But, you know, we had the long weekend.
Mm-hmm.
I got to sit down, really, really sort of dive in. And this game is making me sort of be the completionist that I used to be when I was younger and have not been that person in years and years and years. But I'm going through these levels. I'm playing as Emily. I'm playing stealthily. I've done two no-kill levels, which for me is like never. I've never done Dishonored that way. I've always been like, whatever, I'm going to kill people once things kind of fall apart. Now I'm
Danielle
just like,
Riendo murderer.
Yep,
got it.
That's right. No, well, now I'm turning a new leaf. Now
mm-hmm.
I'm Danielle Riendo, not murderer, at least mostly. I
repentant
definitely killed a lot
murderer.
Of people in the first level, but, you know.
Yeah.
Whatever.
So how are you enjoying it? It sounds like a lot.
I'm in love. I'm in love with this game. It's just, it's such a, like, delicious layer cake of an experience. Like, I'm just sort of diving my teeth into the stealth and enjoying that. I'm enjoying the sort of stealthy combat. So Emily has a power called Shadow Walk that basically lets you get away with anything, and it's the best thing ever. So you basically can get seen, but they can't really see you that well, so you have a lot of room to kind of maneuver around and knock guards out without killing them. It looks like you're really, like, fucking up their shit.
Yeah, I mean, let's be clear on, like, how Shadow Walk works. Like,
you
go from a human to some sort of ghoul on the ground that
Spider
crawls
ghost.
Along the floor.
Yeah.
And then when you know, normally when you knock people out, you just go up and you kind of squeeze their neck, the traditional knockout maneuver. But in Shadow Walk mode, you trip them with your ghoul hands on the ground.
Yeah.
You hover your fingers over their face, and they have a look of pure terror as though you're taking your soul out of them.
Yep.
And then they just pass out.
Yep.
It's off. It's actually
pass
worse
out.
Than killing them. Like, I would rather die
course.
Than go through what Emily does with
right.
a shadow.
Like, what's the rest of your life like after that? Like, no one's gonna believe you that you were shadow choked or whatever. Like, it's your whole life at that point is going to be a long list of trying to convince people that you saw the devil itself and his name is Emily Caldwin, and no one is gonna believe you.
And then you woke up under a pile of bodies.
Well, that's the thing, yeah. The room of
on you.
The room
yeah.
of shadow walk victims that I create when I dump like 8 bodies on top of one another, hoping in my mind that they form some sort of support group afterwards. Because how else do you explain how 8 bodies are stacked on top of each other inside of this office? And then I'll surround the bodies with like glasses and things like that to make it
sure.
seem as though a ritual occurred.
Right.
These
You're
are
trying
the
to
things
ruin
I get
their whole
up to.
Lives.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yep.
Oh, it's so
yep.
great.
How's that going for you, Patrick? Have you continued through?
It's good. You know, yeah, my meta story of Emily Caldwin trying to just wreck people's lives psychologically. She's not interested about regaining the throne. She's interested in just like silently disrupting the psychological well-being of the NPCs in this world.
Right. She's like, if I can't have my throne, then you can't have your lives. Like,
yeah.
Yep. If my life can't be stable, neither can anybody else's.
Yeah, I finished it over the weekend. I really enjoyed it. I think it's a game that, sort of like the first one, has better world building than it has actual storytelling. But that's fine. I didn't play the first one for that. As much as I liked the conspiracy stuff in Deus Ex, I don't play those games for that either.
Right.
You know, you play these games for intricately designed levels that allow you to approach them in a lot of different ways. And like on that respect, like Dishonored 2. Nails it, and then, you know, there are two standout missions in particular. One, which it sounds like you're about to get to, Danielle,
yeah.
And another that comes towards the end of the game, that I don't want to say anything about, but has. Well, I just won't say anything. But there are two levels that are that have, I guess, very unique mechanics in how they operate and how the player operates with them, which is a nice sort of breakup from sort of the general template of a Dishonored level, which is just sort of, you know, going from room to room and dealing with different sort of guard and layout scenarios. These ones sort of fundamentally change how you even think about approaching the levels entirely. And, you know, like they do clever things throughout the game, like sometimes maybe limiting your powers, forcing players to act differently than how they might have prior to that. So they do some cool tricks.
Do you think that we're seeing a trend of that sort of thing this year of like, okay, the thing that comes to mind for me is the sort of like Super Mario Galaxy or just like Super Mario, the modern era of Super Mario games of just like, oh, we figured out a really cool mechanic of interaction. We're going to build a level around that. And then we're going to move on and do something new. Because we've seen that in Titanfall this year. We've now seen it from what I'm hearing in these levels of Dishonored. I even hear that like some of the later parts of Final Fantasy do that this year, where it's just like, okay, for this chunk of the game, it's like this, and like it's a cool sub mechanic, and we're gonna move on. Like obviously, games have had set pieces for a long time, but that's sort of like, oh, we figured out this one thing. Can we build something around it for 45 minutes to 3 hours, and then let you move on with your life? Is that a trend, or is it just happened to be a couple of these instances of it?
I think it's a hallmark of good game design, because there have been, you know, great games in the past that have done that. I mean, the original Bioshock did that, certainly sort of towards the end. Not that that was the best part of the game or anything,
sure.
But I think the sort of idea of approaching each level as its own sort of world, or as its own sort of chunk of the world, as its own approach to the world, is just sort of like, that's great design, you know, that's smart design.
Is that like one way maybe we should start thinking about levels? Is like, I think traditionally when we think about a level of the game, we think about like a narrative chunk or a geographical chunk, where it's like, okay, for this portion there is, you know, this is the Green Hill Zone and everything is bright and shining.
Yeah.
And then when the level changes is when it becomes Casino Night Zone and blah, blah, blah. I know oil, whatever, was in the middle. Chemical Zone is in the middle. I've skipped Chemical Zone. No more Chemical Zone. It's 2016. We got to fix the environment. No more Chemical Zone.
That's right.
Maybe there's a way that we should start thinking about really good, or like a different way of thinking about games in general, like chunking them up in our heads, is to think about when like the sort of conceptual mechanical chunks, where it's like, okay, for this first 3 hours, it says it's three different levels, but like it's basically just zeroing in on left trigger, right trigger, shooting mechanics, cover mechanics, like the basic thing. And then like, oh, then there's this next chunk of the game where it opens up or it adds this new thing, or mechanically it's focused on this, and this, for this next like level or chunk of time. Is that the way that you, as someone who teaches game design, Danielle, like, do you already think about games chunked up in that way?
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, it certainly depends on the type of game. Like Dishonored, I think of as, you know, it's somewhat a story-based game, but it's sort of a game that is about interesting mechanics and with really great world design around those mechanics first and foremost. Mm-hmm. And then they sort of have a story that makes sense of it all, you know, in a wrapper. I mean, a game that is entirely story-based, I think of, you know, much more in terms of like, okay, character arcs, that's how things are sort of chunked into. But yeah, it's definitely, I think, a really intelligent approach. I mean, that's how players tend to approach that sort of game too. Like, what can I do in this level? What are my verbs? What's actually going on? What am I sort of interacting with here? As opposed to, and here I'm on the other side of the mountain. You
right. I think it's useful for me as I'm thinking about, like, so I just started playing Final Fantasy 15, and I'm thinking about it in relation to Dragon Age Inquisition a lot, for lots of reasons.
Interesting. Yeah.
But one of the things that I'm thinking about with regards to Dragon Age Inquisition that I hope doesn't happen with Final Fantasy is there was a moment in Dragon Age where I'd completed the bulk of the game's, like, kind of not dynamic. What's the word I'm looking for? Like, kind of like high quality, highly produced story stuff before the end, but I still had lots of the kind of like big areas that had side quests in them, and even had some like really interesting side quests, but not ones that had like shot reverse shot, like dynamic cutscene style things.
Yeah.
And in my head, that's just one big like mess of time that all rolls together. I don't care if I'm in the Hissing Wastes or in some weird forest somewhere. Those moments of the game, because nothing changed for me in terms of like what my abilities were or how I was interacting with the world narratively or mechanically, that's just one big level for me in a sense. It's like I got through the story stuff. I like leveled up a bunch of things. I got this new subclass. Oh, I got this new super ability. Oh, I finished the main story like arc before the finale. And then this huge chunk of time that's just like, yeah, I'm just doing the same thing over and over. And I'm really, I'm curious if Final Fantasy is going to, how Final Fantasy is going to mix it up. Again, I hear the second half of that game is just a weird, like, complete change around, so maybe I won't have that problem. But I'm it's an interesting way to think about games. I'm going to try to keep thinking about that going forward and seeing if there's something productive to do there.
Well, I wish more games were communicated better about what that side content is or what you'll be engaging with. Like, I think Dragon Age did a poor job of communicating what was worthwhile in engaging with on the side. The Witcher 3 is a game that did a phenomenal job of communicating what are sort of like the junky, tedious experience, you know, like when you're breaking up nests in Witcher, like you are under no illusion when you go to raid a bandit camp that you're going to find anything interesting. Under no illusion that when you go to, you know, kill another set of Neckers in Witcher 3 that, like, you're going to do anything but, like, just
go kill some monsters.
Yeah, go kill some monsters.
Guts.
And
yeah.
But then the game very clearly says, like, these are the side quests that you know are going to have, like, storytelling. Like, there's going to be the stuff you're looking for. And so when I played that game, like, at the end, yeah, like, I had a third tab that was like, here's a bunch of shit you could still do. But, like, I knew it was a bunch of the shit I didn't care about doing, and I'd done all the stuff I did care about doing, because the game...
That's a really good divide.
Is like, it really carefully communicates, like, the difference in sort of import of the various quests so that the player can prioritize what they're interested in doing. And it also allowed me to be more expedient in how I played the game, because there would be times where it's like, well, I'm listening to a podcast and I don't really want to have to pause it to listen to a bunch of dialogue. So, you know, I'm just going to level up and go try and find like some new Witcher gear. And I think that because it was so effective at doing that, I got to play more of the, like, I think what happens with some of these games, like Inquisition, and maybe in Final Fantasy, we'll see how it works out. I end up missing cool stuff because I get so bored of the bad stuff that I shouldn't have to spend that much time looking for it. And if I'm doing that, then the game has miscommunicated either in the interface or how it's, you know, there's something that's broken down, because the player should be able to find that stuff as fast as possible.
Totally. The thing that happened in Dragon Age specifically was that for the majority of the maps, there was like big main story stuff, and then there were maps that just literally didn't have anything like that at all on them. It's like, okay, like, these are cool looking maps. I wish there was cool side stuff here. And then, like, the other thing is, like, with The Witcher, it almost has a diegetic or canonical reason for why there'd be so many, like, shitty, boring grind quests. Like, dog, that's your job. Like, that's what you do. The bulk of Geralt's life is going and, like, kicking a monster nest until it goes away, or, like, going to someone's shitty village and be like, oh, yeah, bandits, killed the bandits. Like, give me my check. All right, bye.
Yeah, we talk about this a lot on Idle Weekend, about how we want every fantasy RPG to basically be The Witcher, because it's so well designed in so many different ways, and the writing is so good, and it has everything about it sort of in its fiction and actually makes sense in that world. And even the boring stuff in that game is like you're saying, Austin, like it makes sense. This guy's job, he's basically like a plumber, only instead of like pipes, it's monsters everywhere. He's gotta like, unclog things. You know?
The thing that's the best about Witcher 3, not the thing that's the best, one of my favorite elements of it is the professionalization of his job by the witch hunters from the church.
Yeah.
Where it's like, yeah, he's not just like a plumber. He spent a lot of his life as like the one dude who knew how pipes work. And now suddenly the church is like, oh no, but we got our own plumbers and they use pipe cleaners instead of like weird pipe ointments. Like, you can trust us. We're from the church. We're good. They have badges. They have uniforms. And he's just like your uncle who knows how pipes work.
Yeah.
And I actually love that. We could talk about The Witcher a lot.
It's so good. It's really great. Yeah.
Holiday 2016, like when we get time off at the end of this year, I'm doing it. I'm going back to The Witcher. The two things I'm playing are Witcher 3 and Hitman. I'm doing it. Yes. I'm committing. I'll stream them both at least once. That will mean it counts as me having played them.
That's right. That's how it works.
I guess I'm kind of burying the lead here a little bit, which is that I've been playing Final Fantasy 15. Not that much of it. You know, I'm only probably 5 hours in at this point, which is either a lot in or not in at all. Patrick, you were saying that you've heard that this is a could be a 20-hour game, theoretically?
I've heard that the main story is actually fairly easy to sort of streamline through, and that there's just a ton of... Like, the world is very dense. We don't know what that density means quite yet. Mm-hmm. I read Jason Schreier and Phil Kohler's reviews over at Kotaku and Polygon, respectively, just to kind of get a sense of, like... I am an RPG fan. I was a big JRPG fan in the 90s when I was first getting into games, but, you know, have gotten away from a lot of that stuff just due to, like, lack of time. Like, even before having a kid, just, like, those games are just rough. Yeah, I don't know. Apparently the main storyline is actually like pretty digestible for like the average human being, and it's just a matter of how deep do you want to dip elsewhere. But I don't know, like,
right.
What is, I guess before you talk about what you think about the game, like, what is your history with like JRPGs, Final Fantasy? For some people, they have literally grown up with Final Fantasy 15.
Yeah.
Like, literally this game has been kicked around for a decade.
That is 100% true, that it is, this game has been around for a decade at this point, which is wild. You know, I grew up playing JRPGs like I think a lot of people. Like, I grew up for a long time.
Favorite Chrono one, stop.
Chrono Trigger was probably my favorite one for a long time.
That's good.
I think that's probably the case. I'm like a Final Fantasy VI Chrono Trigger.
Hell
like,
yeah, you are.
Like, that's good. The dude I am. And I liked...
Shadow and his dog.
There was a moment when I stopped liking Final Fantasy VII that made me reconsider a lot about JRPGs. Like, I like I played the hell. I beat Final Fantasy VII like 3 times in high school. Like,
you had like retroactive regret about enjoying JRPGs because of Final Fantasy VII?
No. It was like,
oh no, I've been fucking it up for years.
So like, in college, I decided that I didn't like Final Fantasy VII because of some gameplay design things. I was like, I want to put on my game design hat. I think this game is poorly made. Like, it doesn't do any of the things JRPGs do that I actually like, which is, like, character differentiation in terms of stats or in terms of abilities. Like, basically, they're just materia gloves. Like, I just... Barrett has limit breaks that are different, but basically, he's whatever fucking materia I put on him. He isn't his own character. And then, like, from there, I started, like... Okay, well, why is it really that I can't get back into this game? Because I know this system well enough for it to be invisible. Like, I could just engage with this game at any point in any way I want to. Why is it that I'm not engaging with it? And it ended up, I kind of realized like it was more about the flow of the game and like the amount of effort you have to put in to find stuff that you really love and a bunch of other stuff that like, I'm not dissing people who like Final Fantasy VII. I completely get it. But then I started thinking more widely, like, oh shit, like I haven't actually really enjoyed a JRPG since early college, late high school. Like, I've put time in, I've played them, I've tried my best to deeply, deeply engage. And I still pick them up now and then and like put time into them and enjoy them. I played a lot of Xenoblade Chronicles X this year. I played,
think the last one I even beat. I'm like going to see if I can find a list of JRPGs from the
there
last
There must be
decade.
A list. JRPGs. What are JRPGs?
Bravely Default was pretty good. Mark? That was a good one. Pokemon, technically.
Right, but like,
I don't know if Pokemon counts.
It's
Pokemon
sort of a light JRPG. It's its own thing, but
yeah, we're talking. You gotta go deeper down the rabbit hole.
Talking JRPG.
Yes, but like, have you talked to people who like really play Pokemon? Like, who really play Pokemon? Because that is a JRPG as JRPG.
Well, yeah, but I'm saying
into the breeding and all of that stuff. That's
we are not those people.
No. Totally. That's true.
I want to pose a question here about JRPGs. Mm. Do you think there's something about the conflation of like late high school, early college, you're starting to become a person, a human being, and you have strong feelings about things, and also you probably have time to play these things? Because I'm in the same boat.
Totally.
There have been JRPGs I've really loved in the last few years, but I wonder if there's like a very ripe time for a young person to get super, super into that genre.
Yeah, I definitely left JRPGs while I still had a lot of time.
Because
I was still playing things like Romance of the Three Kingdoms 10 for 70 hours. Do you know what I mean? Like, I was still dumping 100 hours into Oblivion in college. So, like, it's not like I didn't have the time for them anymore. But I think what it was like, maybe I didn't have the time for what felt like so much downtime in... I didn't have time to grind anymore. And those are games, most of them, not all of them, where grinding was part of the attraction, and was definitely part of the attraction for me in high school. Where it was like, oh yeah, I'm just gonna just do this after school. This is fun. This is a way to kill time.
Or like when you try to think back to what it was like to have 3 months off, you know,
and
having a summer vacation. Like I look back on that and just don't even like want to hit myself. Like, you don't understand what you had.
You wasted it. You wasted it.
But I didn't.
I made those
chocobos have sex, and then I got that Knights of the Round Table summon.
Right, of course.
And I kicked Sephiroth's ass. So actually, it was great.
Part of it, I think, also was just like, those goals don't repeat, right? Like, you get Knights of the Round once, like, I got it. I got Knights of the Round. Check mark, ding, I did it in my life. Like, I don't need to go do it again to feel like a complete person. But, like, I also felt like there were other things happening in games maybe that were more appealing to me at the time, which I'm going to wrap back around to this, which is that, like, it's also around the time that I actually got into Western RPGs for the first time. Like, I obviously played a lot of Morrowind in high school also. And maybe Morrowind is the beginning of me, like, leaving JRPGs a little bit, in that it was a lot of, like, make your own fun. Like, yes, there's still a lot of what you might consider grinding in that game, but, like, it's way more experimental it's experimental in a different way. Mm. It's more about, like, what can I do? How can I mix these things together? How can I go make a weird spell that's going to make this quest easier? How do I go grind for the destruction magic points that I need to be able to cast the spell cheaply? Stuff like that, like, where there's lots of mini objectives that you can achieve instead, like, that you've also assigned for yourself instead of necessarily... to do Knights of the Round, you have to follow this 12-step, like, guide, you know, or like, this multi-step quest where you have to breed the right chocobo so you can run over the water, blah, blah, blah. So I think that was part of it. And then the other thing was just, like, even though I kept liking anime, I stopped liking anime tropes in my games as much, which was a weird thing. Like, I never stopped liking anime, and I still like anime, and I still like Japanese games. Again, like, this isn't a... I'm not saying fuck anime tropes altogether in games. Like, again, I played a lot of Xenoblade Chronicles X this year. I play a lot of Japanese games still. But So I'm playing Final Fantasy XV. Let's just jump to today. Playing Final Fantasy XV. The Final Fantasy XV crew is, like, mysterious prince who's, like, disaffected of the world, even though he is a source of authority and power. There's, like, your smart British tutor friend. There's, like, your goofy, like, comic relief pretty boy, like, younger sibling-ish character who, like, looks up to you. And there's, like, tough, gruff boy who tells it like it is. And he's for real. He doesn't wear a shirt because he doesn't need to because his chest is good. And, like, yeah, okay. And I'm, like, 5 hours in, and, like, I like them because I'm supposed to like them, not because I like them. Like, I like them because the delivery, the execution is okay. It's like, oh yeah, they're doing the thing correctly. Not because they're necessarily really interesting characters. Like, when I think about the best of BioWare's games, when I think about the best of Final Fantasy games, like, I think about Final Fantasy VI, I can name characters who break out of those tropes.
Opera scene,
really well.
Baby.
That opera scene is great. The brothers are really cool. Like, yes, there's a ninja, but even that ninja is dope.
Yeah, man,
like,
his dog!
I know. So I think that there are, like, or when I think about Chrono Trigger, like, all of those characters are really fascinating. Even the ones who, like, fall into anime tropes where it's like, oh, he's a tortured mage. Like, have some, there's enough in that world that transform them to be something more than just that, that archetype. And so I'm waiting to see if Final Fantasy XV does that. It certainly has characters in the world that want to do that, like NPCs. But the NPCs, the world of Final Fantasy 15, FF15, doesn't feel like the world the characters are in. It feels like there's two worlds in Final Fantasy 15. There's like the world of the plot, where you're this prince who's driving across the country to go marry his betrothed, because that will unify the families and stop a war. Like, that's the setup, basically. And then there's like what that country in between is like. I don't know if this is like startling critique on the nature of coastal elites or something. But
let's go with that. That's definitely sounds probably
for real though. Okay, so look, the cities are big and mechanical and weird and like are not at all like the country that you're driving through. Everyone from the big cities and who's connecting to literally the A plot of that game.
So the fantasy Rust Belt. Is this what we're looking at?
Yeah, absolutely. We absolutely are. Because, like, the main characters are all, like, all leather everything, brocade, and fancy tattoos, and, like, good hair, like, good anime hair, and, like, anime eyes. Like, the main character has anime eyes. Everybody else in that game, I guess, like, including his dad, just look like people. It's very strange.
Wow.
But in general, like, it's like the people who are in the main plot are dressed up for, like, the Met fashion show or whatever, whereas everybody else in the main, like, in the countryside is, like, Rust Belt fantasy Americana, like, side-of-the-road diners. They talk with bad Southern American accents. Or randomly, a New Yorker accent. There's, like, a journalist I just met who has just, like, a really bad, like, I'm a journalist, and I know what's what, and I'm here to do good, and I'm gonna get you, and it's like...
I'm gonna get you.
I've also heard the arc of that quest is basically, journalism makes no money, can you help me find a job? Which was like a really depressingly on point.
Yeah, that adds up. And so like, it's really weird to be these characters who are finding the time to help these people go on hunts and like find the minerals they need to like help people who get lost, but also don't seem to be part of the world. Like, I'm not saying that this is the same thing as, like, traditional ludonarrative dissonance. I'm not even talking about the, like, hey, shouldn't you be getting to your wedding? Isn't this supposed to be a big deal? Why are you wasting time helping people with shit that their local police should be helping with? I just mean that, like, literally they seem like they're from different fucking games. I'm okay with it right now, but I would like to see the two things. I'd like to see that talked about at some point, because right now it just doesn't make any sense.
I mean, I wonder how much of that is relative to its development history, right? Like, you know, literally a novel could be written about, you know, what probably happened behind the scenes. You know, I mean, Tetsuya Nomura was originally, like, the director of this, and there was, like, all sorts of... Just, I mean, going back to the history of this game, it's why I'm interested sort of to begin with. Like, I have plenty of other games I could be playing right now. Yeah. Like, I just started playing Mafia 3 again. Like, Watch Dogs 2 just came out on PC. There's tons of stuff I need to get to. But as I wrote in a piece a couple of months ago, sort of arguing why you should play bad games, I'm also intensely – the same way that I watch, like, TV shows that I enjoy – that go on for far too long. I'll remain committed to them. Why I enjoy horror franchises that go 6 or 7 movies deep and eventually make it to space. I like certain things I just have to know. Yeah. And like Final Fantasy 15, and this is true of The Last Guardian as well. Like I just have to know. Like, and we're getting two of those games. You know,
in
I think
row.
The Last Guardian is next week. Yeah. And so 15 is this game that I have to see the credits, because in the same way that I had to finish Duke Nukem Forever, it's just like I've been following, covering, reading about, interviewing about this game for so long. I have to wrap my head around what this thing is personally. I just can't read about it. I have to experience it myself.
You need closure, basically.
Yeah, I do. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Of course. Like, I totally get that. Well, like, and I don't want to give the impression that I'm not having a good time either, though. Like, I actually kind of think that the roadside diner stuff is quaint, and like going into a diner and playing a weird arcade game or like a pinball-ish game is really fun, and like a good way it's rekindling a little bit of that feeling I had in high school of just like, let me just go, oh wow, what's this over here? Like, oh, there's a newness to this that is surprising, even though it's in this 10-year-old development cycle, a 25-year-old series at this point or whatever. I'm finding that I am enamored right now with every new thing that's laid out, even when I'm kind of rolling my eyes at it. Like, I got to a fishing mini game, Each character in this game has a skill, like a life skill. One of them is like survival. One of them has like cooking, right? And he cooks you food whenever you like camp out somewhere, almost like Monster Hunter or something. It's like you're going to get buffs from whatever he cooks, and you're collecting ingredients, and he's learning recipes in the world. Like as he just, he'll like see a poster and be like, aha, like I get it now. I add salt to this and it's good. I'm like, all right.
Oh, that's how my wife picks up all her cooking techniques.
So that stuff is really cool. But I got to a bit where the main character's skill is fishing, and he's the sort of dude, not just the sort of dude who's like, yo, hold on, Entourage, for 8 hours, I gotta go fishing. And like every time you cast and like bring it back, someone will say something like, oh wow, yeah, it's a good fish or whatever. And one time
in a bad accent, like,
no, well, in like it's one of your crews. So
oh,
like,
okay.
Anime
it's not
voices.
One of the bad accents.
So it's
okay.
Like Prompto be like, "Wow, Noctis, that's a good fish," or whatever. But then one time, Gladio, who's like your big buff boy, he's like, "Ugh, you think I could give it a go the next time?" And you're like, "Yeah, okay, no." And like, why are you such a dick, Noctis? Like, could you imagine if I was like, oh, everyone come over for a Waypoint convention? Like, oh, we're gonna hang out together, fun. And then I go, hold up, Danielle, hold up, Patrick, hold up, Mike. I gotta go fishing real quick. Just hang out on this dock for 8 hours. And that's the sort of dude Noctis is. So I'm like constantly rolling my eyes at him, but I'm still like really enjoying the exploring this space and like driving around. There's a car. I changed the color of my car. Like,
apparently you have to fill it up with gas.
You do have to fill up with gas. It's like no money. It's exactly the sort of mechanic that someone was like, oh, we'll make it not a big deal, but it's an important part of the aesthetic of the game and like the vibe of the game.
Should and I like that. That's a really cool
too.
Touch.
Me too. That stuff is really good. You don't like to drive. No one likes to. The dude who drives you around is like, I don't drive at night. There's monsters.
That's reasonable. Come
everywhere.
On.
And so you could be like, your choices of that are like, you have to be like, all right, fine, let's just camp somewhere. Or you could be like, move over. I'm driving. It's nighttime. It's time for Noctis to drive. That's why they call me Noctis, because I drive at night. And it's just like,
come on, leave those jokes to Danielle.
Those jokes are in this game. Those jokes are constantly in this game. Like, every 3 minutes, someone in your crew is making a terrible pun. And so I hope that stuff is really underscored and supported, the sort of like bantery stuff. It seems like it will be, because that's the one way that these characters can, if not break out of those really boring archetypes, at least accentuate them with some extra character. Again, like if you can execute on those archetypes, I'll forgive a lot, you know? So we'll see.
You realize when you said there's puns that was like the first thing that made me want to play the game.
Of course. I mean, like, I think that there's a pitch.
Yeah, what's the
game.
Pun scale of this? Like, that's a new thing we need at Waypoint. Is like,
yeah, exactly. Like,
I need to start
to
writing
dad.
Them down as they happen, because the two that have happened so far were bad. And I don't remember them enough, but I do remember, like, looking at my webcam, even though I wasn't on a call, to give it the old Jim Halpert, like, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, what am I supposed to do with that? It's, like, to the degree of, like, oh, I remember one. You finished a fight, your character's name is Noctis, and your mentor guy, Ignis, is like, you really knocked him out.
And I was like, good. That's great.
Fuck.
That's good. So good.
Okay. I think that there's...
I bet that's great the 25th time he says it.
So there is a lot of repetition of some stuff better. Of like, I think Gladio has told me, my guy has been like, it's really hot out. And then Gladio is like, take off your jacket. But he says it with that cadence. Like, he doesn't say like, well, then take off your jacket. Like, or like, why don't you just take off your jacket? He goes, take off your jacket. And it's like, okay, that's... Okay, Gladio, if you say so. And you can do that. There are, like, costume options that give you stats and stuff. I could take off my jacket to increase my, like, attack speed or something. But
that's really good. That's
armor.
A dumb detail. I'm really
it's
into that.
A dumb detail. I'm into that stuff. Like, so there is stuff like that I'm enjoying a lot right now. The combat is weird. It's action-y, but, like, the camera isn't... I haven't gotten the camera down yet enough to where I feel always in control of battle.
Well, I hear the camera's terrible, so I'm not sure that's you.
Okay, well, that's good to know. But there is a lot of flashy, like, team-up maneuvers that when they work, it works really well, or, like, it looks really stunning. I don't know. There's something here. I need to keep playing it. More thoughts on that in the future. I know Mike Diver is playing it out in the UK for us also. We'll probably chat about it at some point in the next week or two, too. It's out. Like, that's the biggest thing for me. It's just like, oh, right, Final Fantasy 15 is out. Weird. Okay. So,
yeah, it was like, you know, it's been, you know, I'm almost more fascinated by the fan reaction. Yes. Is like the kinds of people that have watched this for this long and have been, you know, I've seen screenshots on Twitter of like people posting, you know, their pre-order tickets from way back when for like, you know, establishments that no longer exist and like stuff like that.
It used to be what, 13 verses? Is that right?
Yeah. It was part of the.
It's wild.
Crystal Las Navales. I don't know. It was part of like a larger thing they were doing that obviously didn't happen. So I'm glad that game shipped, and I'm even happier that it appears to not be Duke Nukem Forever, which is like an extremely low bar.
Disaster.
I want people to be happy. I want people to have been waiting for this game to enjoy themselves. Like even Duke Nukem Forever, a game that I knew was going to be bad because that game was such a product of its time. And also get ready, there's probably going to be a new Duke Nukem game announced in a couple of days. So get ready for that. It's like it would have been so sad if this game sucked. Like it really would have bummed me out if this game sucked, and not because I cared that much, but because I know so many other people that care that much.
The thing is that like Duke Nukem Forever felt like it was stuck in time, like it was trying to do a thing. It was trying to make references to parts of culture that didn't exist anymore. Like Duke Nukem is a send up of like 80s action heroes and like rah-rah Reaganism, and like it did not come out in that era or forever didn't, and yet it was the same. This does feel more of the current time in terms of game design and stuff. Like it does feel like a response to the way that big open world RPGs by people like BioWare include banter between characters. It does feel like a response to the way Monster Hunter and The Witcher have like preparation as an important part of the gameplay like cycle. And that's really cool to see Final Fantasy take that stuff in. I think after 13 felt like such a departure from Final Fantasy, and generally felt like experimental in a way that was we're going to go build this weird combat system that is not like anything else out there at all, and it's going to be cool, but like, and you're going to have to enjoy it on its own terms. It's nice to have a Final Fantasy mainline game that is instead saying, okay, no, we want to exist in this continuum. And I'm not dissing that previous thing. I like having that sort of diversity of gameplay experiences. So I like seeing what they're doing inside of the current kind of like collection of popular trends and stuff. In the same way, I'm looking forward to Breath of the Wild, the new Zelda game, for that same reason of like, come up in here and fuck it up. Like, do some new shit that inspires other people to do new things instead of just going off and making your own completely distinct thing. I talked more about Final Fantasy than I thought I would.
There's a lot there, it seems.
There is. So I'll check back in with me on that. Really quickly, three other real quick things. One, I beat Mafia 3.
Nice.
Good ending. There's a cool thing on the way to the final mission that is just like the thing that they do with the radio that's really cool. So if you beat that game, look out for that. I talked to people who beat that game and didn't notice this happening. Pay attention to it because it's really fun. It's like, it's really cool. That game is a little too bulky for its own good. It's the story stuff is fantastic. I love the ending. It just needs like a third less content.
Yeah.
Ding. I beat Watch Dogs 2. I think that game ends really poorly.
Oh no.
And the last act is just kind of weak. It has its own high moments going in. There's a thing at the beginning of that last mission that's really cool too. You won't miss it. But I kind of feel like there's a point at which a lot of the energy of that game is deflated and it never really recovers, and it has to do with the way a specific mission is handled and feels latched on. I still generally like it. I love those characters to death and wish that it had some of the Mafia 3 sort of respect for its characters. Sure. And then last, I played some No Man's Sky because there was a patch for that came out. We should hit that really quick because there was a patch for No Man's Sky, the most hated game of 2016. I would say
a patch is probably selling it short. It seems more like
an update.
Mini expansion, yeah.
Yes. You want to talk about it a little bit, what's come up about it?
Yeah, well, Danielle, you wrote the story on it, yeah.
Yes.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was just there's a survival mode, which is apparently also allows you to sort of build little mini bases sort of around a given planet. There is apparently, I haven't played it yet. It's still downloading. It's like on my machine downloading right now. But from what they had in the video, from what they were talking about, what Hello Games was talking about, There is a base building mode. That's what they actually called it, the foundation update, because of this, because I think this is probably the thing people are most excited about. This is what I've seen the most people actually sort of talking about. So you can build these big multi-story bases now. You can actually use them to house crops. So you can always have your iridium or heridium or whatever the hell you want in there. You can have up to 10 crops in there.
Both. I need both.
Both, yeah. All the idioms, basically. yep, you like that one. See? And also, apparently, also, the interface has been beefed up a little bit. You can actually stack items so you're not juggling and miserable
Yeah.
So you could stack a limited amount before, but if so I did this update. You can't stack things. You can stack things in ship inventory, in presumably in your base inventory and freighter inventory.
Yeah.
But like you can't, if you have two of those glowing balls, whatever those things are called,
neutrinos or whatever,
you can't stack them in your inventory. But when you move them back to the ship, they start stacking.
Okay.
So it is it's a way for them to encourage you to build out your base and get more storage in your ship. And now to buy one of these super expensive giant freighters.
Yeah.
I feel like there's way more of those big. Do you know the freighters that are in No Man's Sky that are like the big like capital ships that fly around sometimes?
Yeah, I always get excited to find one.
You can land on those now and buy them. And then you can be like, oh, yo, warp into me and like come to this planet so that I can drop off some shit to you. I want one real bad. Like the thing about this new update is I think it's out of the progression mechanic that's going to get me back into the game. When you first build a base, you just like, oh, you find a base. So here's my like 5-minute story on No Man's Sky. Landed at a base, or like 5-minute story is wanted to do base building, was stuck on a planet because I didn't have the fucking plutonium to launch. Spent 18 minutes looking for the plutonium, found it, got in my ship, left it. Was like, I'm gonna find a cool planet to have a base on. Spent 30 minutes looking for a cool planet, could not find one. Finally found one. Really beautiful green fields, huge like plateaus, island planet. So there's lots of, you know, little islands with like big plateaus coming out of the sea. Nice seafront property. I found a base. I decided to take over the base. You like install a construction thing, and then it's like, hey, you need a person who knows how to use construction equipment. So you go up to the space station and hire someone who can do that for you. And then you come down, and like, this is the new hook. This is the way they're, this is the new thing. He's like, awesome. I want to build a science station now, but I can't. I need X. I need a special new resource that didn't used to exist in No Man's Sky called Blastrium.
Good.
Blastrium, sure. It's not that at all. And the only place to get that is from these like purple cactuses that only show up on barren planets.
Huh.
And like the second I read that, I was like, oh, I see. And so then I had to go find a barren planet. I looked over my list of planets that I'd been to, found a barren planet, went to it, got the stuff from one of those, from those cactuses. Really useful thing. Went up to the space station at that star system. There's teleporters at every star system, at every star base now, every space station that will teleport you back to your base directly. And then from your base, you can teleport to any space station that you've teleported to your base from. So there's like very much like fast travel across the galaxy at this point. And so came back, installed the science station, recruited a science officer, and he was like, awesome, I got some new shit for you. But first, I need to go get this thing from inside of caves. And so it's like, oh, fetch quests is what they've added to No Man's Sky. But you're talking to someone who put 80 or 90 hours into Starbound when that came out, 112 hours or something.
Nice.
In the first version of Starbound, which was just that sort of progression mechanic, like science upgrade loop. And I think I'm going to probably get back into No Man's Sky. We'll see. We'll see how it goes. But I think that loop is really cool. I think that the changes to the inventory stuff work really well. You can fast charge all of your stuff without going into your inventory now. Like, it's stuff that should have been there at launch, for sure.
Yeah.
And I think, Patrick, you were saying earlier to me off of mic that, like, oh, this will be a good game a year from now? Or this will be a game to play?
Yeah, Danica was asking whether she just got a PS4 and she was thinking of downloading it and... my recommendation was give it a year because I do get the sense they are really committed to this game and we're not going to suddenly get No Man's Sky 2 announced, you know, next spring. I think the worst thing they could probably do is announce a sequel to No Man's Sky.
Oh yeah.
And my guess is this game is probably going to get at least a full if not, maybe not a full year, but a long period of free expansions that get it closer to what people had in their head.
Yeah.
And that I wouldn't be surprised if they started charging for it maybe a year from now as a way of continuing it forward. But I bet this game looks almost completely different, you know, 18 months from now, even a year from now, even 6 months from now. I do think like they are going, like my guess is like a lot of the basic mechanics and core loop of what you even do in this game don't even exist 12, 18 months from now. And which is funny, having that dovetail into our discussion about like sort of like, you know, digital archiving and the history of games. Yeah. Like if you buy this game in 2 years, you might look at it and go, man, what were people so pissed about? Like, it's possible that's the reaction you have.
Totally.
Because that's what I hope, because I didn't find what you found in that game. It didn't speak to me in that way. I spent 10 hours really looking for it, and it just didn't strike at all. Like, it's partially because... Go ahead.
It was just exactly what I needed at the time. And I in general, I lean in that way towards games in general, those sorts of like, it's what I was saying about Morrowind earlier, which is like, make my own objective, go do that thing, give me a ton of stuff and I'll find my fun in it. I found my 20 or whatever hours of fun in No Man's Sky though, and then like left it and hadn't thought about going back. So I think I said to you again off mic earlier, like in that conversation with Danica, I was saying, I actually think that everything in that trailer, in those early trailers, is now there in this game. But the stuff that isn't there is what those trailers evoked, that there was something bigger than that. I guess not everything. I still don't think that big fucking snake is anywhere in this game.
or like it also just doesn't happen very fast, right? Like, that's also the problem with No Man's Sky, is that like, there are moments like that. They just don't happen with a frequency that if you're not ready for a game that you're going to spend 20 hours and have a couple of revelatory moments.
And then like the other thing there too is just like, they don't hook into anything bigger. There's no like big faction war that you're part of.
No, the story is garbage.
The story is garbage, right? There's nothing there that like actually moves you to engage with those systems besides the systems themselves.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in the systems themselves, so that helps for me. But for the vast majority of people who need not apologize for this, they don't give a fuck about the systems unless they're tied into something a little bit bigger. So I'm curious to see how they address that going forward. So we'll see.
Yeah.
Let's take a quick look in the question bucket before I have to run to a meeting that starts in 10 minutes, even though I'm still at home. I'm going to probably get a car to get to work today. But I'm going to look at this question first. And this comes in, it's a short one. This comes in from Elwood. It's a good name. I like Elwood as a name.
Nice.
Hey, Patrick, Austin, and Danielle. I want to ask you a short game design question. It's been bothering me for some time now as I'm starting to learn game dev myself. Can a game be an FPS with gunplay as its mechanic but still be considered deep, quote-unquote, and a sort of personal expression? Really curious to hear your opinions on this. All kinds. Keep writing awesome stuff. Thoughts? Like, I think we kind of generally, when we talk about first-person shooters, I think that maybe this feels to me like it's a response to a sort of line of discourse wherein we kind of dismiss first-person shooters, not as not being fun, but as not being artistic or not being personal or not being a reflection of the designer, the way we talk about walking simulators, the way we talk about, you know, indie games. And we often interview designers of all these other types of games and say, like, oh, wow, how does this reflect your life? No one talked to the people who made Doom this year and said, like, what was really going into this process? Like, how did you connect this to you? And for me, I think that, like, yeah, of course it could be, these things can be deep and aspects of personal expression. But what about you two?
I mean, I think that's what Portal was, sort of, or at least started out that way. I think, it's all about designing around, if you still need to sort of have that mechanic in it to satisfy the requirements of this question, that's fine. There's almost infinite possibilities. That's the cool thing about game design. You could certainly make a game that's about discovery or about a very personal expression or a personal memory or a personal experience, using that as a core mechanic and also sort of designing around that and on top of it and underneath it and, you know, sort of thinking three-dimensionally with it too.
Yeah, I think just by the very nature of sort of like, you know, bigger games and first-person shooters who tend to be sort of these, you know, AAA big projects, like in order to appeal to wider audiences, like sort of ideas get generalized, stories get generalized. So like, I think, you know, we focus on it because it appeals to us, because it speaks to like something very specific. And it's not to say some of these games don't do that, but like sort of by mantra, they aren't doing that because they are trying to appeal to an audience that it's a wider hook. And so I think like it's not surprising. I think smaller games maybe speak more narratively and larger games speak more mechanically because that's just like an easier way to bait, you know, tens of millions. That can't happen, but I think, you know, if you look at the last, you know, 10, you know, 10, last 10 years, like where we've seen sort of the rise of these different approaches to design and games that have been more personal that have come because game development has gotten democratized in a way that they can tell those stories in video games. Like AAA games are getting a lot better. You know, we're talking about Mafia 3, that stuff is happening. It just happens, as we've talked about, like at, you know, more glacial paces. And I think 10 years from now, like, the distance between those two things will be a lot closer.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to get a lot more of those personal stories in bigger games. It's just, it happens at a slower pace.
I would encourage us also to break out of thinking about the word personal as a superlative, as a positive. There are lots of games that tell personal stories that I think are bad.
Sure.
Yes.
I you know, it's not necessarily my job to dunk on those games all the time. Like I one person poured their heart into this thing. It's not my job to do traditional reviews about evaluation or whatever. But the other thing is like there are ways to talk about big games that were made by dozens or hundreds of people that approach them the same way a music critic approaches different sorts of songs or different sorts of albums, where you're evaluating them in this like way about what their depth is, but that it isn't about narrative, that isn't about lyrics, so to speak, that is about like the construction of the sound in a song or the construction of a gameplay loop or something in games. So like this year we have like in just the FPS space, Doom, Titanfall, Overwatch, Call of Duty Infinite Warfare, Battlefield 1. There are tons of successful first-person shooters this year that all feel really distinct from each other. They've all found, like, obviously, a lot of these are left-trigger, right-trigger games. A lot of them have some overlap, but Doom and Titanfall are both games that are incredibly fast but feel completely different if you play them at high levels. And so I think we should learn how to engage with those sorts of differentiations, not necessarily as a reflection of, like, oh, this connects personally to the gameplay designer's life because this is a time they were on a train and blah, blah, blah. But it does reflect a certain sort of aesthetic sense that a studio has and that a studio wants to explore in the same way that like a new album from a musician can want to explore a different sound or like look at the difference between like My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy and Yeezus. Like, oh, wow, like that is the difference between like Titanfall 2 and Doom, right? Like there is there's a different set of ideas that are being explored in terms of like what fun is and what interaction feels good and like different methods of flow and all that stuff. And that's really fascinating and like a way that we have not necessarily been trained to talk about at a high level or at an entertaining level. It's so much easier for me to be like, this is what anime voices sound like, and for people to laugh about it than for me to like talk about, like Patrick wrote in a really good article today about Effects and Cause, the Titanfall 2 level that is fantastic that we've spoken about a couple of times now. You should go read it. But like that, it's hard to write about that stuff in a way that will translate to a wider audience because you're talking about mechanics and design. And thankfully, Patrick got some really fantastic quotes, which helps always.
It helps. So. Yeah, it helps when you have like designers that can articulate that, you know,
yes,
like the,
totally.
And especially to bridge the gap between, readers that you're trying to communicate to, writers like myself that have a limited vocabulary on how to even, like I remember in the Titanfall piece, one of the things I wanted to get to was to explain or try and understand technically how the game, mm-hmm. how the level works, and you're switching between timelines. And I was just upfront about it. I was like, I don't know how to ask this question, but I think how I phrased it was like, when I played the game, I kept thinking, how the hell did they do this? So I was like, I'll just throw it to you. Like, if somehow in layman's terms, like, how does this level work? And if that's uninteresting, explain it anyway, because it might actually be interesting in a way that you don't understand. And, it, you know, ultimately it is interesting because they stack two levels on top of each other literally in the level editor. And that's a fascinating way to think
it's
of
so
how
cool.
they figure that stuff out. But, you know, I think also I can also sympathize with readers who, like, a lot – if you've been doing what we do for a long time – like sometimes you get bored with certain stories. And so I think there has definitely been an overcorrection by folks like myself and others who have sought out these more personal stories and written about them and in a sense promoted them because you know, you do this for 10, 15 years and just like you need something new to grasp onto. And I think you saw that in a lot of people, you know, like, you know, flashpoints like Gone Home and things like that where it's just something new and different, and personal is new and different. And so I think sometimes sort of like we in the like quote unquote media can overcorrect in that sense and forget that like there's a lot of other stuff out there that people are still interested in, even if you've maybe gotten a little cynical or bored.
Because we've done so much of it, right? Like when you try to, when you have to, when you have to keep up with every first person shooter that comes out, having something that, that plays with the first person shooter genre and then like pivots to be this other completely different thing is going to be really appealing for us. So that's just part of the gig. Yeah, it is worth thinking about. That's worth thinking about. Yeah. If we were an NPR show, that's how I would end the show. Instead, what I'm going to say is thanks, as always, to our producer, Tim Barnes. Thank you, Danielle and Patrick. You can find all of our stuff on Twitter at Waypoint, on Facebook at Waypoint by Vice, at waypoint.vice.com. I'm going really fast because I have a car arriving at in two minutes to take me to a meeting.
You got to export your audio and send it to me.
I'm going to export it and upload it. It's great.
Good.
Find our music, the Bowen, Miss You is the name of the song, bow-en.info. You can just come to our website, waypoint.vice.com. That's where it all is. That's where it all lives. Stay tuned for more stuff from us this week. I hope you had a good holiday. I hope December doesn't freeze you to death. Peace.